it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Well, Harm, a new week, and this team is still on a roll. Can you believe it? We are talking about a Canuck team that has won four straight. So much to get into on this episode of the VanCast, including Aiden McDonough, whose season at Northeastern is over, and we expect his signing with the Vancouver Canucks to be imminent. Nobody is expecting anything else, right? We don't expect them to go to free agency. We do expect them to be here. Wouldn't be shocked if there was an announcement shortly after we recorded. We're not going to re-record at that point, but we do expect McDonough to be here. We will talk about that later on in today's show. But the Vancouver Canucks have won four straight, an impressive 5-2 victory against Ottawa. They raced out to a 4-0 lead, hung on for a couple minutes, and then put it away with an empty netter to win 5-2. That is their seventh win. They're 7-2-1 in their last 10. So just as many of us predicted, and primarily because of the schedule and because we knew at some point after the trade deadline, and we thought maybe even before, that Thatcher Demko was going to get back into the lineup. All those things have played into what really isn't a surprise, the Canucks ruining their draft position. But this is more than just a Tocket bump, who's now had, I think, 19 games. This is a team whose form, within the context of those other things, the schedule and the goaltender returning, their actual overall form is getting better.
Yeah, longest winning streak of the season in March when the games don't matter at all. I think this is the most Canucks thing ever. It's both hilarious, predictable, and painful, all three things at once. But you're right, it hasn't just been the soft schedule now, right? Because they've beaten an Ottawa team that's been really hot in 2023, had a ton of stakes to play for. It was really a must-win game for the Senators. They had so much on the line. The Canucks also not too long ago beat Toronto. They also not too long ago beat Dallas at a time where the Stars were kind of struggling and really needed to find their way again. So the Canucks have found a way to beat some quality opponents as well and do it in a way where they've mostly controlled play. Like, I look at that Senators game, and to me, when they got ahead to that lead, sure, it got a little bit dicey once there was the delay of game penalty and there was only a 2-goal lead, but for the most part, they controlled that game. I wasn't ever really worried where earlier in the season, right, the Canucks would race out to 2-0 lead and you'd go, like, you'd already know that it would that it was going to fall apart, that the other team would come back. Your first thought was, okay, they're up 2-0. They need to score at least two or three more in order to actually win this hockey game. And I didn't actually get that feeling watching the other night, which is a sign of comfort that I haven't had with this group this season. I look at the way that they've been sort of defending, even in that game, barely allowed anything off the rush, right? Like, I think that's the biggest difference, is that they're not trading chances in transition. You're not seeing those odd man sort of breakdowns. You're not seeing those egregious mistakes. And look, we'll see if they can sustain this over the course of next season when the games actually start mattering again. But for right now, it's looked pretty darn impressive.
Yeah, and I don't want to run past the if it carries into next season. I mean, we see this from teams on a regular basis, that you play games with no pressure. Teams generally play you differently, regardless of what the stakes are for them, just because you don't necessarily have everyone else's A game. You see a lot of backup goaltenders. Like, there's a lot of this that goes around teams that just aren't very good. And, you know, we're seeing other teams in the league right now have similar results in terms of, you know, 22 points over a 19-game sample size. Anaheim and Arizona come to mind. So do we see anything here? Because a lot of people felt, you know, We're going to get so many people dunking on the media for being critical of Bruce's firing when in reality, nobody in the media and most fans really in Canucks Twitter weren't really criticizing the decision to fire. It was more how it was handled, right? We knew that this was going to happen after the most brutal schedule stretch for the Canucks, and it was going to come before the easy stretch. But there were people that were suggesting that, okay, well, you know, the whole thing is they want to rebuild culture and they want to rebuild structure. That's what the organization said, that those were the priorities right now going into this. This was going to be an extended training camp, an opportunity to teach everyone what it looked like to be a Vancouver Canuck and how it looked like to play under Rick Tocchet and the structure and demands that were expected. And that was going to carry into next season. Do we buy it? Because we see teams with this late surge when there is no pressure on them and they don't get the respect of their opponents. So do we think there are tangible reasons to believe what we're seeing now in terms of form will carry into next season?
I'll be honest, Farhan, anybody who tells you that they know with certainty whether it's going to carry over next season or not is lying, right? Because you can see it on both sides of the coin. You look at the positive side of the spectrum, you can point to the fact that the roster on paper should have been contending for a playoff spot anyway. There was no reason for them to have been as bad as they were in the first half of the season, even just on talent on paper. Demko should bounce back, and we've seen that. That's something that we should expect moving forward. They are legitimately playing better, more organized. They're not making nearly as many boneheaded mistakes. They will get a lot of help by adding Philip Peronik on the right side of the blue line. And in the offseason, look, it could require pain in terms of buyouts, retentions, and sweeteners. You're going to have to pay the bill for it later down the line. But if management really wants, they will be able to carve out at least some cap space to, say, add another top four defenseman and at least shore up another couple holes. But then on the other side, it's like we saw this play out with Bruce Boudreau last season. And like you alluded to, I don't value games where there's no pressure the same way, where there's zero expectations. For whatever's happened recently, we can't ignore the fact that this team choked in October. The whole narrative around training camp going into the season was a slow start has killed us the last 2 years in a row. We know we have to hit the ground running. We can't dig ourselves an early hole. They still went 0-5 on that first road trip. Became, what was it, like the first NHL team in history to start a season by blowing multi-goal leads and losing in regulation in three consecutive games, right? Like, it wasn't just that they lost all five of those games. It was that they would build these leads, choke, and collapse under the pressure, right? So they folded, they buckled, and I just like that's something that still sticks with you, right? So, like, it's kind of apples and oranges with these games down the stretch. And especially the other thing to kind of keep in mind too is early on, you're always, I shouldn't say always, but generally speaking, when you look at the data, there usually is a coach's bump when a new guy is brought in, right? Everybody buys in early, especially because players are trying to make a first impression, right? It's a blank slate, fresh start for every player on the roster. You're highly incentivized to try and leave a really good impression and show that you're buying in and doing exactly what the coach wants. We'll see if that buy-in and commitment will last over the course of an 82-game season next year. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. You can point to reasons on both sides of the spectrum, but until they can show that this is real in October, we're not going
to
know.
Yeah, you're right. Like, at the end of the day, all signs point to it being better, right? I mean, you know, you mentioned, the tangible improvement in play. There are certain players who simply are going to be themselves, right? I mean, there's moments from a guy like Tyler Myers where we see a couple games of, you know, low event hockey, and then all of a sudden we see, you know, who the player is. And there are others on the lineup that are just like that, right? You know, we certainly expect a guy like Oliver Ekman-Larsson, if there's going to be a buyout candidate, it's probably going to be him. That'll save them cap-wise next season to the point where they can add somebody. Demko, I fully expect to bounce back. You know, I think what we saw from him at the start of the year was a bit of an anomaly and more of the mental recovery from injury than physical diminished play or anything like that, right? So I do think there's certain things that are going to point in the right direction. You know, we still haven't seen Mikheyev, who obviously we saw him in October last season. We saw him through Christmas, but, you know, he's going to get back in the lineup. There's going to be a number of things that can augment this team to get to where they need. I think we can still see them roll out, you know, three legitimate sets of wingers when the dust settles. I think now you've got guys that, and we'll get into them a bit later, but Dakota Joshua knows them on. And, you know, we've seen so many bottom six forwards masquerading as top six forwards. These guys could be a really good fourth line or two thirds of a really good fourth line for the team next year that could chip in and give them meaningful minutes and all those kinds of things. Like, there's a lot of things that are pointing to that direction, but let's see what happens when the pressure's on, to your point, right? The only guy I wonder if he could sustain what he's doing is Kuzmenko. Like, the guy's been ridiculous, right? Whereas Petey, we know, is going to be Petey. And Quinn Hughes, we know, is going to be Quinn Hughes. But there are going to be some others that I'm curious to see if they can play the same way again. But it'll be interesting to see what this group looks like after a training camp with pressure and expectation. And everything's pointed in the right direction. But until they do it, we just don't know. And, you know, so you can't get too far ahead of yourselves. And I know that this is probably going to massage the hurt, the anger from season ticket holders. You know, and I've said that in terms of process, nothing's going to change around this team until fans stop coming. And what's happened is that they've given the reasons for the fans to come again in the fall. Rightly or wrongly, that will happen. People will believe that what we're seeing under the new head coach will carry into the fall, and we'll see if it does. But, you know, organizationally, you know, that's the one thing that's going to potentially require change. But what we also know, you know, we're talking about the positive signs of all of this first. We do know that Team Tank is dead, right? Like, there's no coming back from this. 7-2-1 in their last 10 games. Right now, there's, you know, the bottom four spots, in my opinion, in the league seem to be unreachable for this group, right? Like, it's, you know, when you look at it, you know, in terms of the gap and everything like that, you know, the bottom four teams in order from bottom to top are going to be Columbus, San Jose, Chicago, and Anaheim. Even Anaheim is playing better. They're 5-2-3 in their last 10. But, you know, I think the gap, because Vancouver is 7 points up on Anaheim entering the day. Anaheim's played two more games, so that, you know, helps Vancouver. But, you know, when you look at it, above them, you know, I don't think, even on this run, right, like, who are they going to catch? They probably can catch St. Louis, right? And St. Louis is playing poorly. Vancouver's playing better right now. But Detroit is 8 points ahead of Vancouver right now. I don't know that they're catching Detroit at this stage, who's in 24th, Vancouver's in 25th. So right now, to me, the range is 24 to 28. What's the percentage? I think there's about a 2.5% difference. You'd have to correct me if I'm wrong, between 24th and 28th in terms of lottery odds. Is that about right?
To me, the difference in odds in terms of landing the number one or number two pick isn't as significant as just being able to guarantee that you'll get a higher pick. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of being, you know, fifth or sixth as opposed to eighth or ninth, right?
Sure. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm looking at this, and even in terms of, like, I'd even be really surprised if they find a way to get as low as 27th or 28th with the way that they're playing and the way that and how undermanned the teams below them are, right? You look at, for example, Arizona. It was interesting because I was looking at this data over the weekend, looking at the best and worst top pairs in the NHL this season in terms of goal.
Arizona was surprisingly top 10 because of how well Jacob Chychrun had been playing. And meshing with Shane Gostisbehere. Well, both players got dealt at the deadline. They traded their entire top pair away, which was such a driving force for them. It was playing at a level in terms of goal differential that was top 10 in the NHL, right? So that has a significant impact impact on them.
Philly's lost three straight.
When you compare Vancouver and Philly's rosters paper, like, it was shocking that Philly was ever above
Vancouver for as long as they were. The Canucks on paper are so much stronger, and same thing with Montreal. Now that they've now that Cole Caulfield for a while has been done for the season, their best goal scorer. So I'm looking at the combination of these factors, and at this point I'm just hoping that they don't pass St. Louis, The other thing to keep in mind is Jim Rutherford and Patrick Elvin had to know
that this was a possibility, right?
Sure.
Experienced enough to know
when you bring in a new full-time head coach, you're
to get an initial bump. Part of that has to do
with the new coach,
of course. Part of that also has to do with
every guy. It's a kick in the rear that, okay, I've got to get my stuff together. I've got to prove that I'm worth keeping around. I got to get in the coach's good books. That sort of leads me to, like, when we were talking about talking initially getting hired, a lot of our conversation was centered around the idea that, okay, it's
chosen 30 games left in the season to bring in,
right? Like, I think we were saying, if you wanted to fire Boudreaux, absolutely do it. Do that in timely fashion. Don't leave him hanging in the wind. But then let Mike Yeo take over on an interim basis and then hire Tockett with, let's say, a few games left in the season. So it does minimal damage to the tank. But that shows you how much they value next season, right? Which aligns with what they did at the deadline in terms of acquiring Filip Peronik. They're essentially okay with picking lower in this year's draft and trading that for Tockett having a longer time to establish the culture, the accountability, the structure that he wants so that the team can hit the ground running for next season.
Yeah, you're right. And it's interesting because I remember when we went in and talked to Jim Rutherford about the Tanner Pearson situation, right? And the medical staff was there. And one of the things he did say is that, yeah, we can, as a front office, make moves that are reflective of the draft, right? And that's not to suggest that they were going to rebuild, right? Like, we've debated that. It could just be make decisions for the draft so that we can get the higher pick, but then all the other decisions that they would make would line up towards a shorter-term process, right? So, you know, the timing of it all, you know, we're going to debate it, and, it, you know, we're certainly past that point. But when you look at it, it's probably hit a number of agendas, right? Because we certainly believe that ownership is driving the timeline, right? The short-term build or short-term retool versus rebuild. But all of those things are hit because now, again, the way this team's playing, they're still going to be in that bottom group. They can't be in the bottom four anymore, but they, you know, they're still in a position to potentially be low enough. They've still managed to get set up for next year with culture and structure. And they've managed to win enough games to make the owners happy that maybe we'll retain a few more season tickets, right? Like, has there been a downside to how it's played out relative to what the club's value of next year is?
Yeah, the way you laid it out, I think that is a priority as opposed to trying to maximize every percentage possible and picking at fourth or fifth as opposed to ninth, right? So. No, absolutely. I think you're bang on correct there.
Before we go to take a quick break, I do want to talk about one thing Tockett said. Let's get into it fairly quickly, and that's Brock Besser. He talked about this the other day in the morning of the Ottawa game, and he suggested that, you know, he thinks Brock's doing a lot of things, was pretty pointed about the fact he thought he was still inconsistent, needed to get in the forecheck more. It can't just be him waiting for JT Miller to do all that work, and he's got to get a bit more consistent defensively. But he still felt that there was enough positive, and he wanted to be involved with his offseason. And, you know, I asked him about, you know, how do you manage that with a guy that is, you know, clearly wants to leave? And he said, well, maybe he'll have a change of heart, right? Maybe things will go so well for him down the stretch that he'll want to come back. What do you see from... Were you surprised about the comments? And B, what do you see from Besser? Because I'll tell you, when I posted that comment on Twitter, the reaction I got back from Canucks Twitter was pretty negative towards the player, right? And just a reiteration about just how bad the player's skating is, how unengaged he is. Certainly no sympathy for anything that he's been through. You know, from my perspective, I do think they should move him. But I'm not on the Besser sucks, get him out of here narrative. That's not where I'm at. I do think there's a little bit more for this player to give. I just don't think he's going to give it here anymore. And I'm not telling you he's intentionally checked out. I just feel that the best of him won't happen until there's a change of scenery. I think Besser's a good guy. I think he's been through a lot. I think many of us hope that he'd be able to put a lot of what he'd been through behind him this year, you know, because his dad had passed and it happened, you know, in the offseason, and, you know, he's had some time, and that, and he himself has said that I'm really looking forward to this season, and this is the season I'm going to bounce back. And yet there were more injuries. I just think that Boeser's a good guy, and I hope he's able to rebuild his career and get closer to his potential elsewhere. This is not a get him out of here. I like Brock Boeser. I want Brock Boeser to do well, but I think it's going to happen elsewhere.
I think a lot of fans are kind of in that boat. First of all, I'm not too surprised to hear Tockett say that, because he's been a pretty blunt, straight shooter.
And really what he spoke was bang on correct in terms of assessing Boeser's game, where it's like there's another level to unlock. We need more from him in terms of the details. Because you think back to, for example, the 2019-20 season, or even the year after, part of the appeal around Boeser was he'd rounded his game out. Now, all of a sudden, he is winning board battles at a really high rate. Again, I remember seeing the statistic from Instats data where Boeser was among the best forwards in the league in terms of the percentage of puck battles that he was winning. He was really effective on the forecheck as well. Those elements, it isn't just the goal scoring. We've seen those two-way elements completely erode as well, to where he's not doing it on a consistent enough basis. And yeah, I mean, it's still strange to me how he's put up as many points as he has, because on a night-to-night basis, it is really tough to notice him sometimes. I mean, you might see the odd chance in the slot, but he hasn't been clinical with his finishing. But also beyond that, we're just not seeing him make an impact or stand out in a significant enough way. He's invisible on a lot of nights. So it's been tough. And ultimately, you're right. Like, they just need to figure out a fresh start, not only for his sake, but also for the team now, especially with how much money they have tied up on the wings, how much talent they have. They find a way to reallocate
that money. But for that to happen, they need him to hopefully catch at least some fire at the end of the season, so that teams can at least see a spark, see some reason to believe that it could be different if they acquire him.
Yeah, I think there was a 4 or 5 game point streak a few weeks ago, and really nothing since. And for all that said, as much as I want for the player that he's able to get that fresh start, I wouldn't offer a sweetener. I just wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he can still bring relative value compared to some other players that they're going to roll out there in their top nine. Right? He's not going to be a big drop-off from all but maybe two of their wingers. Right? So I'd like to see the move on for pennies on the dollar, I wouldn't give a sweetener at all. I wouldn't retain money at all. If it comes to that, fine, come back here, right? And then we'll try again next year where there's less term on your deal, right? But I don't think there'll be a significant drop off between Brock Boeser and, you know, all wingers not named Kuzmenko. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, independent
brings a lot of value, which in today's world you can't really, like, it's nearly impossible to be able to separate the two. I think what you mentioned, though, in terms of, like, you have no interest in, for example, retaining,
I think that's where it would become difficult, potentially. I could see a situation, at least sort of just like thinking out loud logically, where it's like, let's say a team is interested, they're willing to give you an asset for Boeser as a player, but they're like, retain $1 million. Right. Like, at that point, like, that's something that I would consider if the asset is valuable enough. And A, and B, if I look at that open cap space and I think that there's something meaningful that I can do with it, right? If you look at the market at the time of that possibility opening in terms of free agency, in terms of trade opportunities, and you go, well, there's not a lot on the available on the market realistically that we could do with this chunk of change, then you might go, all right, it's not worth it to retain it at all.
Hang on to him,
hopefully rehabilitate his value, try and move him down the line. The other side,
that, you know, $5.5 million that you might open in cap space if you retain $1 million in a sort of trade, if you look at that and go, that could help us land a real meaningful
difference maker, somebody who can move the needle, and we can't acquire that
sort of piece unless we're able to move on from a player like Ben,
then you might have to really consider it. Then a move
at might have value for you.
And round this out with Tockett's comments, he did finish by saying, whether it's here or elsewhere, he's got to be better. Truer words were never spoken. When we come back, we'll talk about the newest soon-to-be Canuck winger, Aiden McDonough.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Harm, before we get into the Aiden McDonough conversation, let's talk a little bit about just how the Canucks are deploying their top players. And obviously, you know, Tocchet has admitted that he's competitive and that he wants to win. And even when we've seen moments of Podkolzin and Kravtsov playing late in games and playing in overtime, we're still seeing heavy minutes going to Vancouver's top players. So just going back to the Ottawa game, where that was a comfortable win. I mean, it was 4-0 till well into the third period. I think 6.5 minutes left when Ottawa started scoring. And, you know, we're still looking at 22-22 for JT Miller. We're still talking about over 24 minutes for Elias Pettersson. We're still talking about well over 28 minutes for Quinn Hughes. If he doesn't get the late penalty, he probably gets to the 30-minute mark. Are we surprised that they're still going this heavy with the stakes being this low?
I'm definitely surprised. I mean, you look at the last 10 games, Hughes has averaged 27-40. That's the most minutes of any player in the league. Nobody is managing a heavier workload in the NHL right now besides Quinn Hughes. In the last 10 games, Pettersson has averaged 22.05. That's the most minutes of any forward in the league besides Connor McDavid. Even look at JT Miller right now. He's seventh among all NHL forwards in that sort of 10-game stretch. And the gap between him and number four, Nick Suzuki, is only 5 seconds, right? So he's knocking on that door as well. So you've got three Canucks players right now in terms of your top guys who are logging extremely high numbers here in terms of their usage. To me, this is unnecessary mileage, right? To me, I'm thinking, save this for next season when the games actually matter, especially because this is the end of an 82-game grind, right? This isn't happening at the start of a season. This is happening when, inevitably, over the course of the type of travel that this team has to go through, being a West Coast team, all the games that they've already played, you're inevitably going to have knocks, nicks, bruises. It just happens, right? I just worry and hope that you're not at a point where you're risking any sort of injury, any sort of wearing a guy down. And obviously you're going to have the summer to sort of recover. And so it's not a huge concern, but I just don't understand why it should be such a high priority. Again, especially when you have a player like Vasily Podkolzin, who against the Senators logged 8 minutes and 5 seconds, right? Yeah. At a time where games don't matter, development should be the priority. But this is, again, where you get to the point where I'm wondering the same thing you were, where it's like, is this team trying to sell hope for next season, get people to buy in, ensure that season ticket renewals go well? I wonder if that's part of the equation. I mean, I don't know. We would never sort of know with certainty.
I think you're bang on. We're certainly allowed to speculate that. It makes no sense why these guys, number one, like, imagine in the 24th minute of a game, Elias Pettersson gets hurt. You know what I mean? Like, that criticism will come back to bite the team. Or Quinn Hughes playing 29 minutes of a game and late in the third period, Quinn Hughes gets hurt. You want to be criticized as an organization, that's going to top the list right now. So I'm not suggesting you put these guys in bubble wrap, but let them play like regular minutes. And I don't mean regular for them, regular for most, you know, top players in the league. Or just get them down to, you know, get Pettersson down to 20 minutes, get Hughes down to 23 or 24 minutes, right? Like, we're not talking about putting these guys on the bench. But yeah, and the younger guys that you mentioned could probably use a bit of ice time. And generally, I haven't been overly critical of how they've handled it. I mean, you know, I still would like to see Nils Höglander get some games up here, right? And I certainly think that they're doing a good job in Abbotsford getting these guys to play similar systems and doing the things the organization wants them doing going forward. Certainly, there's alignment there, especially with Ryan Johnson. But I'd like to see Nils Höglander get up here. And I'd like to see what Jack Rathbone can do with the current structure, right? And I don't know that there's much more than that because the AHL defensemen that they're playing, and we'll talk about them a little bit later, those guys are mid-20s, right? Like, they're not young prospects in this organization. So if all of a sudden you decide you want Jack Rathbone to be a sweetener for another trade down the road, how about you get his value where you need it to be, right? You know, if you thought that Nils Höglander was showing offensive flashes but wasn't doing enough defensively, you've given Podkolzin his opportunity. Do the same with Höglander. Like, is there a contractual reason for them not to have him up here for a small number of games right now? Is there a waiver risk in having him up here and having to go back? I'm pretty sure there isn't. So why isn't he here? And look, it's not a deep prospect pool. So it's not like there's a number of egregious decisions going on. But this could be, there could be a couple. And again, just within the theme of play some of these other guys less, play a few of these other guys more. But I do think that winning now is the reason.
Yeah, with Höglander, I disagree personally. I think he strikes me as the sort of player whose confidence got pretty low when you look at the version we saw of him as a rookie compared to what we saw from him under Bruce Boudreau, just in the sense that you could see it in his finishing a lot of the time, right? Where he's looking a lot more nervous. He's missing the sort of chances that I don't think he ever looked hesitant about.
So you're talking about the start of his
NHL career? Yeah.
Yeah, but again, he's been down there the entire season, right? Like,
Hasn't been that long. It hasn't been the entire season.
No, but they got sent down pretty early in the process, both those guys.
You also got to remember that Höglander, he missed a lot of development time in terms of what a typical second round pick should have gotten with American League time or even more time in Sweden. He was fast tracked to the NHL because of a situation where all he had to do was beat out Louis Erickson and Jake Virtanen for top six spot. And the organization has acknowledged that even when we had our conversation with Ryan Johnson on the podcast last year, that, hey, some of these guys are probably fast-tracked, and that in hindsight they probably needed more seasoning in the American League. So for him, he's cooking there. He's building confidence. He's scoring goals every game now.
My point, right? Is that, look, I believe that there was value to sending him there. I'm not being critical of the decision to send him there and to have him down there for the majority of the season. But if you think Nils Höglander is on your NHL roster next season, and I think he should be, right? This year has been valuable for him, but that doesn't mean that 10 games back in the NHL at the end of the season, with that confidence having been built because of how good he's playing there, and having the head coach see him and having him learn the structure and the system and be awfully motivated to make an impression, both offensively in terms of his finish, as you mentioned, and defensively where his game was lacking prior to being sent down, get him up here. Now, if you're only going to play him 8 minutes, there's no point, but I'd like to see him up here. I'd like to see Rathbone up here. And I'd like to see them at least getting double digits for minutes, right? Like, get them 11 or 12 minutes. We're not talking about 20, but I think there's value to that too in terms of his development. And again, this is not me saying he should be up here. They were right for sending him down. You know, I think when we talked back in August, you know, I know when I had a chance to talk to Jim Rutherford at one point, like, they were saying that, look, it's not the worst thing for these guys to spend time down there. And you're right, but that's happened, and I'm not saying it's done. He's still going to play for Abbey in the playoffs, right? Like, those minutes are still going to be there, but to get him back up here for a small sample size and to get another taste with the eyes of the new head coach on him can't be a negative, can it?
Sure. If you're talking about like 8, 9, 10 games left in the season, you decide to bring him. Yeah. Okay. Max. That's fair. I'll agree with you on that.
I'm not telling you he's back to being a full-time NHLer. I didn't suggest that for a minute.
I thought you were more suggesting that it needed to happen like right now, like with
no.
You know, however many games. But yeah, like 8, 9, 10 games left. Yeah, for sure. Especially with, like, if a guy like Kravtsov continues to not show a whole lot and Höglander continues sort of lighting up the lamp. Yeah. If you know, give him several games down the stretch to make an impression, let the head coach see. I 100% agree with you on that.
Well, because you're also going to get another young guy here who hasn't earned his time. Aiden McDonough, as we get to our next topic, and you know, we're expecting his signing to be imminent here, and we expect him in Vancouver in a matter of days. Solid regular season at Northeastern, 38 points in 34 games. Season ended in the Hockey East tournament quarterfinal this weekend. He was a nominee for the Hobie Baker Award. So, boy, the Canucks sure know how to draft in the seventh round, right? Point is, he's coming right to Vancouver. And I know part of that kind of, it has to happen a certain way. But for him to come to Vancouver, he's going to be a young guy. You know, again, a player that should probably get 8 or 9 minutes for the first couple of games. But eventually, I'd like to see him play 10 or 12 minutes. And let's see what he really looks like. What are we expecting from McDonough? Take me through his game and what Canuck fans should look for.
Yeah, I don't think that he's necessarily going to be ready for a full-time NHL spot next season, like right from October. That's not what I'm expecting. If it happens that way, if his development is accelerated, perfect. That's awesome. The team could always use more ELC contributors, but still, in the big picture, I think he's got legit bottom six potential. Now, it's important not to get ahead of ourselves and suggest anything more yet, just because we saw with Adam Gaudette, right? Won the Hobie Baker after his junior season. He had 60 points in 38 games as, you know, a year younger than McDonough is right now as a senior. And he didn't become anything more than a bottom six player. That still had value, right? Like, I've seen some people suggesting that Gaudette was a bust or, you know, didn't turn into anything, which isn't exactly true because he still gave the Canucks a lot of NHL games. And even if it was just one season, he put up, I think it was 33 points in the 1920 campaign. He centered a sheltered bottom six line. He was a major contributor for the second power play unit. Like, that was the year where the Canucks were able to squeak into the playoffs. Like, that sort of, you know, value has impact has value, I should say. Now with McDonough, I think he's intriguing because, first of all, he's got good size to him, but it's also the other qualities in terms of the great shot and the good instincts for getting open, which is key to me, right? Sometimes you have a situation with players in college or lower levels in junior where they have the great shot, but you wonder about how it's going to translate at the NHL level, where you look at the other tools in their skill set and you're like, sure, it's easy to find space to uncork your shot in the NCAA or in junior, but how are you going to do it at the NHL level? Like, do you have separation speed as an offensive player, or like, what other traits do you have that will ensure that you actually get time and space? Because like, we've seen it with a lot of players over the course of time, they find it so much harder to get time and space to actually pick their spots. And this is where with McDonough, his instincts in being able to find soft parts of the ice, I'm a big fan of those types of instincts. And that's going to be key for a player who isn't exactly a burner. So that combination for me, in terms of the size, the offensive smarts, and the good shot, to me, it makes him hard to defend down low, off of the cycle. The other interesting part that I'm really curious to see the status of is his board play, because at least at the NCAA level, the reports that, you know, I'd sort of gotten was that he's got a solid detail-oriented style along those boards. He's got a high battle rate. That's important because Rick Tocchet's spoken a lot about how he wants more sort of wall guys, right? Guys who can win battles along the boards, who have some size and oomph to them, who can contribute on the forecheck. Again, I'm not expecting that this impact will necessarily be instantaneous, but McDonough, at least as a prospect, seemed like he was further ahead in that process of learning some of those details than prospects who are usually, let's say, 21 or 22 years old typically are. Again, in terms of, you know, you look at the other side of the coin in terms of what he needs to work on, it's his skating, right? Like, keeping up and adjusting to the NHL speed is going to be his biggest challenge, but he's a legitimately intriguing prospect. And it's a big win for the organization that they've gotten to the point now where he's going to be part of the long-term future, as opposed to, I mean, if you asked me last summer, I was legitimately worried. I would have figured you know, I was looking at it as a 50-50 in terms of whether he was going to sign here or not.
And now there's some other potential NCAA guys that are on the radar. And, you know, this is the thing with him. Like, especially you mentioned the fact that he went back and played a senior season. He's now 23. So generally with guys that spend their full NCAA eligibility or even three of the 4 years, you do wonder what the ceiling is, right? And I think most observers feel that he's going to be, as you mentioned, a bottom six, maybe a middle six a winger at best, but probably, you know, he turns into a third line winger and can provide value for a lot of years. But the team's also in the mix on some other free agents, some forwards, some defensemen, some, you know, right shot D, some local players. Take us through some of the names and what we can expect.
Yeah, I think right off the bat, Jake Livingston is a player. It's a right shot defenseman who's pretty intriguing to me. Seems as if the Canucks have a decent shot at landing him. We'll see. There's obviously going to be a lot of teams interested. The one thing that I know Dranser's brought up that I sort of am curious to sort of see how this dynamic unfolds is organization seems to be pretty high on Filip Johansson, who's having a big season in Sweden. Johansson, of course, was Minnesota's late first rounder in 2018. He was a reach at the time. Like, everybody was like, looking around as if to say, really, they selected him in the first round. So he's not really a first round caliber prospect. Minnesota, of course, decided not to sign him. And they picked up a compensatory draft pick as a result of that. But he's had a solid year logging some pretty big minutes over in the SHL. So if you look at a player like that and go as a young player, he may be in the mix for, you know, signing him to an ELC and contending for, you know, pushing for a roster spot in a depth role, or at least being a major contributor in Abbey. Like, I wonder if that affects the way that a player would look at the opportunity here, right? Because typically that's the biggest thing that an organization like Vancouver can offer, is the opportunity to be able to sort of compete for NHL minutes right out of the gate. So I'm curious to see, because that's one thing that in this process, from having spoken to NCAA guys that have gone through this courting process before, that's what they do in terms of, like, they'll go through team by team, looking at the depth chart, looking at, okay, how feasible is a path to the NHL? Are we going to face roadblocks? And so I'm curious to see how, like, you know, like a player like Livingston's camp, like how they view that that dynamic. But there are also some, you know, a couple of center names that could be available. So we'll see at other positions. But, you know, seems like there are, I think, the indication that we've gotten, at least for the public scouting industry, who would know a lot more about this than I would, or you would, or anybody else who covers the Vancouver Canucks. They've been saying that it's a pretty strong crop of NCAA prospects as a whole. So I'm interested to see what kind of noise the Canucks are hopefully able to make, and maybe they're in a position where they can sign a guy or two.
Yeah, let's start with Livingston, who's from the Fraser Valley. He was born in Creston, played his junior hockey in the Valley, plays at Minnesota State Mankato right now. 6'3", 205-pound right shot D. Canucks are also in the mix for Cornell defenseman Sam Malinsky, who's another right-handed defenseman, a little bit smaller. And you mentioned Filip Johansson as well, a right-handed defenseman. So obviously that's the organization's biggest need right now. You've also got Akito Hiroshi. Am I saying that name right? That plays with Livingston on the left side. So, you know, obviously defense is a big priority. And there's also a couple of center names as well in and around all of that. Do you get the sense that they're favored for any of them, that any of them are a long shot, that any of them are, you know, potentially NHL ready sooner than later? I mean, you've got to like a player like Livingston size for sure. I've read some reports that, you know, that his skating is pretty solid for a player his size, but that's obviously an area that he still needs to work on. What, like, you know, what should their priorities be?
Well, I think big picture, like you mentioned, in terms of where are some of these guys leaning, I don't think we're at the point now where that activity is really like that. That'll ramp up over the next week or two, especially as more teams become eliminated in terms of a priority. I mean, like anywhere, whether it's like particularly center or anywhere on the back end. Like, that's why not add more prospects? I think if you have more wing guys, you're looking at a spot where it's like, okay, like we're pretty well stocked up there. We're in a position where even with our own sort of winger prospects, it's becoming a pretty significant logjam. And I'm sure, again, a lot of these representatives will look at the winger situation in Vancouver and they'll maybe be more reluctant. But yeah, there are plenty of, whether it's centers or right shot defensemen, left shot defensemen, they should be in on anything they can get if they believe that that player has the potential to provide NHL value down the road.
Yeah, Max Sasson is the main center candidate that Drancher and Dhaliwal have mentioned in their article about NCAA players out of Western Michigan, a 22-year-old there that's a right shot. So we'll see if they can land one or two of these guys. I mean, even one at this point, because it sounds like a number of these prospects, while the Canucks are definitely in on them, so are at least a dozen NHL teams. So Vancouver's got their work cut out for them. But opportunity, of course, is their big selling point. And, you know, we talk about McDonough as well as, you know, as a important player for this organization. And you're right. I mean, he's going to come here. He'll burn the first year of his entry-level deal. But I think there's a real possibility that the bulk of next season for him gets spent developing in Abbotsford before he eventually circles back. But with any of these NCAA players, you expect or hope to see them sooner than later. And it's not like NCAA free agents are gold, right? They're just opportunities. There's not a huge number of these guys that have come in and made a major impact that weren't previously drafted, right? I mean, I think Chris Tanev is a name that comes to mind. Tyler Bozak is a name that comes to mind. But there aren't a lot of them that come in here in the last 20 years into this league and make a big impact right out of the gate, or even a big long-term impact.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you're hoping, even if you find like the next Troy Stetcher, right? Like that still has, that really moves the needle, because it's not just you find those guys and they provide whatever value they do. They're going to do it at a really cheap rate because of their entry-level contract and having cost controllable years beyond that, right? Like hypothetically, I don't even know if this type of player exists, but let's say there was a scenario where you're able to find another sort of depth centerman who is a right shot, can win faceoffs and helps you on the penalty kill. Even if it's a guy that is a 13th forward for you who is just competing for a spot with Nils Åman, like that could help you. If there are injuries, or if you need, you know, if the penalty kill is really struggling and you're looking at a guy that you want to fill a niche role to win draws and be able to help you defensively, those sorts of depth roles on the back end, I guess maybe it's not as much of a maybe it's not as much of a pressing need, because some of these Abbotsford guys have shown that they can hold down depth roles. But like anything you can do to juice the value of your organization's depth, I think is meaningful, because over the course of the season, things happen and guys end up in unexpected spots in the lineup. Look at last season, right, where the Canucks were battling for their playoff lives, and Alex Chiasson had to play in a top line role essentially with Elias Pettersson. Who would have thought that at the start of the season, when Chiasson was initially signed to a PTO, that the club would be relying on him in a huge sort of playing with Elias Pettersson role in meaningful games to try and make the playoffs, right? Like that's just what happens over the course of the season, where unexpectedly things happen. And sometimes it's, you need that next man up mentality. So absolutely. I think those guys, even if they're not like, you know, top six forwards or top four defenders, they can still hold significant value for an organization.
You mentioned that there might not be as big a need for bottom end forwards because of some of what the Abbotsford players have been doing, or some of the, you know, the offseason pickups have been doing. I want to ask you a bit more about those guys when we come back. So Harm, Dakota Joshua, Nils Åman, Sheldon Dries, Phil DiGiuseppe, who just got a new 2-year contract. All these guys have impressed me. Like, I mean, I think that all four of them should make a case to be here next year. I think they're all best suited in a fourth line role. I know that DiGiuseppe's been getting a lot of ice time on a second line. And, you know, we're seeing Sheldon Dries up and down the lineup as well. Who's impressed you the most, and who do you think is the biggest ceiling?
Yeah, I mean, ceiling wise, I think all of them are still fourth liners, but they've been really good. And the difference between having, let's say, a modestly below average fourth line and a modestly above average fourth line can really have value for a team next season that we expect is going to be fighting tooth and nail for one of the final playoff spots in the West. Those the differences on the margin sort of add up. And for me, in terms of the immediate standout, it's been for his entire body of work this season, Dakota Joshua. Mm-hmm. The way that he's been able to already chip in with 9 goals in 62 games. If you're able to get a player who can chip in, like he's probably going to hit 10 goals here. A guy who can hit 10 goals on the fourth line, like that means something legitimate, because for a long time we've seen, back when, for example, Jay Beagle was on the fourth line, or like after Antoine Roussel had sort of, after the ACL injury and his knee wasn't the same, the offensive, the fourth line had become a bit of a black hole offensively. So to be able to have a player like Dakota Joshua, who is able to add that offense, still bring size and some level of physicality, who is competent defensively, who has some level of skill too, and in just being able to make plays generally. Absolutely. Like, I think he's been an excellent find for this team. But up and down, it's like I go and all those guys have made a case to be part of the solution for next season. Because Nils Åman, for example, I look at the playmaking since, for example, the Dallas game. That's where it first stood out to me. I'm going, this guy's making plays that I never saw at the start of the season. And again, it's still within the capacity of a fourth line role. But all of a sudden, if you see that level of playmaking combined with Joshua's hands and finishing touch around the net, that's where you see more goals like some of the ones recently, where it's like Amon and Joshua are feeding off each other and setting each other up, and they're elevating one another. So that's great to see. That's exactly what you want out of a fourth line. Sheldon Dry's also hitting 10 goals. I mean, as a depth contributor, 10 goals might not seem a lot, but to get that out of a guy who most of us expected to probably spend more time in Abbotsford than in Vancouver, that's huge. And to have the versatility and being able to play both center and wing, it matters. I mean, he was holding down, and you definitely don't want him in this sort of a position next season when games actually matter. But as a placeholder, he had to play third line minutes, and at least he wasn't a total sort of train wreck. He definitely wasn't the solution there, but it wasn't like it wasn't bad enough that we were talking, oh my God, look at how bad that third line is right now with Sheldon Dries. Like, they've got to find an immediate fix. Like, you need players like that that can sort of plug holes in DiGiuseppe as well. Absolutely. I think he can be a competitor for a fourth line role. The question for me now is going to be, going into next season, who can potentially separate themselves as a penalty killer as well? Because that's what this team is probably, that's what it's probably going to come down to. Because like, all these guys can provide a little bit of offense in a sort of bottom six role. All of them are competent defensively at 5-on-5. Now, all of a sudden, it's going to be one of the team's biggest priorities for next season has to be shoring up the shorthanded play. Who's going to differentiate themselves among some of these depth guys?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think in Nils Åman's case, you've also got to improve on your faceoffs, right?
Like, that's 100%.
That's got to be an area that they can roll you out there at critical times in games, and you can at least give them that. But he's shown a lot of other elements to make for a quality bottom line center, right? And for me, Dakota Joshua tops the list because primarily his size. And
yeah,
the guy's got really good hands for a player his size. We have seen some goal scorer goals. And even the Nils Åman goal the other night against Ottawa, like, not only was it a power move to go hard to the net, but just he eventually had the puck taken off his stick, but just he had it inside. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he showed really good hands to get the puck inside. And ultimately, it was Åman that cleaned up the change, but or cleaned up the garbage, I should say, that was there. But at the end of the day, there's a ceiling here for this player. And I'm not suggesting that all of a sudden he's going to be the second coming of Todd Bertuzzi, but there is a ceiling here. And I think Ryan Johnson saw it when they were sharing a team during COVID with St. Louis. And, you know, I think that RJ is a pretty good talent evaluator, and he's certainly doing a good job of development. But I think this is a player who can be, you know, a guy that scores 15 goals at some point down the road here and can get you 25 points in a bottom line capacity, right? So I do think that there's, you know, to quote Drancher, there's a lot of there. So I think when you look at ceiling of all of these guys, I think he's one. I think they've given him the odd spot on the PK, and Rick Tocchet says he likes what he sees to this point. But again, a guy that certainly has the skating ability and the length and things like that. He's got some traits that would indicate he could be an effective penalty killer. But that's one thing this organization really hasn't had enough of, is they've had a rolling cast of bottom six forwards, but none of them have been effective penalty killers. They got Curtis Lazar this offseason with hopes he could be an effective penalty killer, and that just never happened. So I think if he can do that, if Oman can improve his faceoffs, I think they've got some guys here that can be, as you say, a slightly above average fourth line, and you can provide some value on the margins for that. So I don't like that we both have the same answer in Dakota Joshua, but here we are. So let's see if we can have a different answer as far as the defense is concerned. Because you've got Guillaume Brisebois, who just signed a two-year extension. On top of that, you've got Noah Juulsen, and you've got Christian Wolanin. You know, and the one thing about Phil DiGiuseppe, as we go back to the forwards, PDG, in my opinion, on form, was good enough to have earned a spot. I'm not telling you he's the greatest hockey player ever, but I think he was one of their best 12 forwards a year ago at camp and this past year at camp, and didn't get that spot. And you know, and every time he comes, he shows it. He shows he belongs. So look at these three defensemen now. Christian Wolanin, and we talked about it earlier, and you were right. Like, stop talking about what should be a sixth defenseman. But as we project forward, he has absolutely lived up to what his training camp and preseason performance indicated he could do, right? That I know people refer to him as a quad A player, right? That he's probably, you know, a player that could dominate at the American Hockey League level, but doesn't quite belong at the NHL level. He looks just fine to me. I think Kyle Burrows, you know, like why Riley Stillman was playing above him in so many situations under Bruce Boudreau. I'm sure that was organization driven because they acquired him in a trade, but you know, I like what I see from Burrows. You know, some of these defensemen, are they part of the solution? Or are they merely going to be depth players that are quad A guys that can come up and help you? Can any of them be part of the Canucks top seven next season?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Wolanin. I think based off the last pod, it was like when we recorded then, it was so early in terms of still a relatively small sample. And so I was like, okay, like I was kind of like a, let's see if he can kind of keep it up sort of thing. It's been great so far. And he surprised me. Like I was wrong for brushing that conversation aside so early. Ultimately, yeah.
Love like, it. Just write that down. If our producer Daniel Lehman could just clip that and we could play that in a promo. Boy Genius saying I was wrong.
Hey, I've no problem admitting was correct. Wrong. Oh, yeah, I've been wrong a lot of times in the past. I'll be wrong plenty of times in the future.
I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, with Wolanin, I don't think it's changed the trajectory of his ceiling, but it does say two things in terms of, one, could he be a 6'7" moving forward, which is also why it was so like important to be able to get off of Stillman's cap hit, because it's like, why would you pay almost double league minimum when you've got a guy like Wolanin now who based off the sample of games, you're confident can be a reliable 6'7", right? And then even with Kyle Burrows, like he's the sort of guy that I'm looking at now that the club has gone through the process, at least started it, in terms of re-signing some of these depth players with Guillaume Brisebois, with Phil DiGiuseppe. I hope Kyle Burrows is one of the guys that that is next, because I look at Burrows, he can play both sides, left and right. He sticks up for his teammates. Look at the way that he, after that Watson hit on Patterson, did not hesitate to go after Watson. Who else on this roster would have challenged Austin Watson, a guy who's a couple classes above Burrows in the weight category for sure? Like that was extremely ballsy for Burrows to do that. And to me, that sort of stuff still matters in terms of having that toughness, especially now that you've dealt a player like Luke Shen, just to be able to have a guy that can stick up for his teammates, build that camaraderie, have a bit of that Wolfpack mentality. I think that's important for this roster to have. He's great character in terms of with depth defensemen, just generally speaking, it's important to have guys that will always be a positive influence, will always have impeccable practice habits, will always be a breath of fresh air in the locker room, regardless of if they're playing or not. And that's what Burrows is. It doesn't matter if he's in the lineup, if he's out of the lineup, he's always in a great mood. He's always going to add positivity. So local kid as well. Like, so, you know, that's great. And the other side of it that matters, I think, in looking at how well these depth players have performed is, I was having this conversation with Drancer about a week ago. If you're seeing this level of step up where these guys are where these Abbotsford guys are stepping in with a player like Oliver Ekman-Larsson out, and they're holding the fort down competently, just because they can skate well and they're not making major mistakes, I think that speaks volumes in terms of what impact a legitimately good defenseman like Filip Ruohonen could have, right? Like how much of a benefit could the Canucks see just in terms of addition by subtraction, you know, in terms of, you know, Oliver Ekman-Larsson, for example, or Tyler Myers, if you're able to move on from him once his bonus is paid. Like, that's at least a positive too, is not just can these guys sort of be depth contributors for next season, because I don't ultimately see them doing much more than being number 6-7D, but it also says that once you bring in actually decent defensemen, you know, maybe you could see huge strides for this team on the back end.
But there's some decisions to be made, because you've seen them make one with Guillaume Brisebois, right? They gave him an extension. And, you know, with a lot of these things, you know, are you going to get a one-way deal, or are you going to get a big minor league number? But you've got Kyle Burrows is going to be a UFA. Christian Wallanen, a UFA. Noah Juulsen, an RFA. Ethan Bear, an RFA. We know they're down the road in terms of contract negotiations. It hasn't necessarily gone great, right? We've heard that they're talking about a one-year deal. They're talking about a three-year deal. There haven't been many discussions since the All-Star break, which is generally an indication of those discussions not necessarily going well. But Bear is prepared to bet on himself with a one-year deal if that's what it takes, right? Currently making $1.8 million. We know that Bear is going to be back next year in some capacity, right? So you've got to make some decisions on some of these other guys. So
do we know that?
What's that?
Like, do we know that? I mean, do we know that with certainty? Because
no, we don't. But I think the reports to this point are that, you know, he would settle on a one-year deal. Now, if he had a one-year deal, does that all of a sudden make him a much more movable asset? But it would appear to me that they want him to be one of their top three right side defensemen. Do we not?
Yeah, I mean, I'd assume probably. The only thing that I, you know, was sort of wondering was because he's played a decent chunk of minutes here in terms of the arbitration case. Like, that he's an interesting candidate in terms of you've got to weigh your options. And, you know, I've been wondering, I never look at a situation for a player with a decent potential RFA case and go, that's a guarantee that he's going to be qualified. Again, I'm with you in the sense that I'm assuming he's probably going to be back. I was just curious because I was like, do we know that sort of thing? So
yeah, for me, I'm expecting him back. I'm not telling you that that's a done deal, but certainly all signs point to, you know, on a worst case scenario, him coming back on a 1 year deal and betting on himself. It certainly sounds like he's prepared to do that. I don't know that they just let him walk away and don't qualify him.
Fair, yeah.
Especially given the track record the organization has had, and at $1.8 million, I know his cap hit is 2.2. Like I'm trying to get a sense of where that qualifying offer is going to sit in terms of whether or not there's going to be an advantage then to try to get him extended at a lower number and what that would look like, right? But nonetheless, I'm fully expecting him to be part of this blue line next year. So do any of these other guys wind up with one-way deals, or do they wind up with $500,000 on a minor league salary on a two-way deal? You know, who do you prioritize? Can they get more? Can a Wallanen or a Burrows, have they done enough that they can get more in the form of opportunity elsewhere? Can someone look at these two guys and say, okay, you're going to be, you know, in our top six, and we're going to pay you accordingly, and we're going to term you accordingly? I'm curious, because I think all of these guys provide value to this organization. So you certainly hope there's a way they can keep them all in some capacity, and whether they're ready to just go and be that quad A player, I think is a good thing. And this organization needs more of that, right?
If they want to, sorry to jump in. If they want to, they'll be able to keep them for sure. Like you were mentioning in terms of opportunity elsewhere. The thing is, they're like Burrows and Wallanen are flying under the radar outside of Vancouver, right?
Both teams of them are 27.
Especially, exactly. And especially now that you're at a point in the season where teams are Like, they're just not going to put as much stock in a team like Vancouver's performance this season overall. Nobody's really going to be paying attention to the Canucks. So if the Canucks want those guys to be back, I don't expect it'll be too difficult at all, which is good flexibility and options to have.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see all of those guys back, and we'll see if they can make that happen. As for us, we're about to wrap up here. The Canucks have one more game remaining on a season-altering homestand that has seen them win far too many games than many tankists would like, but here we are. So they play Dallas tomorrow night before heading out on the road for three. They've got Thursday in Arizona, Saturday and Sunday back-to-back in Southern California, first LA, then Anaheim. Our next show is going to be next Monday, a week from today on the 20th, before the Canucks play two more home games after that. And then at some point over the course of this month, the rest of the month, Drancer and I are going to do at least one more live room. But the next two shows for the remainder of March are both going to be on Mondays. So today the 13th, then the 20th, then the 27th. And if you're looking for other podcast options, we've got Rob Pizzo, Jesse Granger, and Michael Russo. They recap the GM meetings from Florida on an all-new roundtable on the Athletic Hockey Show on Wednesday. You can also get a new subscription to The Athletic for just $2 per month for 12 months when you visit theathletic.com/vancast. Anything you want to add before we jump?
Nope.
Four straight. How many will it be when we come back after three more or after four more games? They'll have played four. Okay, give me an over-under. What do we got? Four more games before our next show.
I mean,
they're going to win three. I'm telling you right now.
Three?
Over under 2.5.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I don't know. I'm not a bettor. I've never placed a sports bet in my life. So
that's the one thing you have not learned from your boy Drancer.
I haven't. And I don't want to get into it.
Don't
either.
Do it. Don't do it.
I don't want to. I'm going to steer clear.
Yeah, numbers guy like you would flat out go in the wrong direction on that experiment. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for logging on. We will be back next Monday.